You're listening to the Leaping Cholla podcast, recorded in the Wrong Mountain Yurt in the Sonoran Desert.
I am falling away from this world. I am falling away from this world. You are calling.
This is episode, what is it?
I don't know.
Episode 5?
Well, that works well because we're on section 5, so I think we should does it? Keep it like okay. That.
Episode 5 of Leaping Cholla. I read something. I thought I would start with something not in the book that I thought was interesting. Is that okay?
Mm-hmm.
I'm reading this book called, Heidegger, The Question of Being and History by someone named Jacques Derrida. I'm not sure who that is. No, I'm kidding. By the very famous Jacques Derrida. And I think it's a series of lectures that Derrida gave on Heidegger when he was a professor. Fairly young professor, I think. I mean, it was like, I think it was mid-60s, early. He said something in the book. He said, an assertion that is perhaps trivial, but irrecusable, meaning undeniable, we never leave the present. Life, in the sense in which life is the opening of the difference that allows appearing, life, animal life, or the life of consciousness, life in general, life is living only in the present, and the living present is a tautological expression in which, in any case, one cannot tell a subject from a predicate. And he says this kind of during a conversation kind of about how Heidegger talks a lot in Being and Time about how the first beginning or original metaphysics has led to us feeling like an overemphasis or a predominance of presence or presencing, that everything is the present and that all philosophy is the philosophy of presence, what is before us, in front of us, what is present to us. And that parlays into Heidegger's emphasis on time. And Derrida talks a little bit about how, you know, what was in the past comes to us as present, and we make it present, and it appears present to us, even though it was in the past. And the same with the future. As we look at projections into the future, we only relate to it as being present to us. The consciousness has become kind of a presencing. And I thought about our conversation about anxiety last week, and identity, and the facets of identity, the ways in which identity separated itself from the self. And I thought this last line, the living present is a tautological expression in which, in any case, one cannot tell a subject from a predicate. So the distinction between subject and predicate is really important. Basically, like, the definition of predicate is the part of a sentence containing a verb and stating something about the subject. It's essentially something that states, affirms, or asserts something about the subject of a sentence. It's kind of, it's the descriptor of the subject, or it's what the subject is identified with. So where am I going? I'm trying to go to this idea of where I was talking about identity and anxiety being linked up, and this idea of presencing and the living present, and the subsumption of all of time into a present, into presence, which is something Heider talks a lot about. I would say that, if the living present, according to Derrida, is a place or a state in which we can't tell subject from predicate, we can't tell the thing or the person that's being talked about from the things or the persons or states that it's being identified with, they become indiscernible. Then it seems to me that somewhere in there is this really cogent link between identity and anxiety, because it feels like a little bit a part of anxiety, as you've talked about it, is that things that are in the future feel really present, and or things that aren't here yet are, like, in other words, they're just what ifs, you call them, mm-hmm. are really present. And in that presence, the subject and what they identify with, or what they're identified as, the identity, the identity of you, you can't be distinguished from what you're identified with. So you become again, enslaved or inextricably attached to your predicates or your identities, mm-hmm. and become imprisoned by them. And so, I don't know, there's something there about, mm-hmm. and so we get back to Heidegger and we get to time, and it's kind of like, I think that Heidegger's emphasis on time has as its under motivation this idea that instead of experiencing the past by presencing it, we need to try to figure out a way in which the past is experienced as the past, without it being presenced. And the same with the future. Because mm-hmm. if we presence everything and we think of everything as present or in a living present, as Derrida calls it, subject becomes indistinguishable from predicate. We become imprisoned by identity, and anxiety follows. Mm-hmm. So that was something I thought was kind of cool.
That was cool.
I don't know if that conjures any thoughts in your mind, but we could just go and start reading Heidegger, if you'd like. I'm hoping something I discussed could also, I mean, I think we'll probably hear reverberations of that as we go.
Yeah, totally. It sounded so unlike Heidegger, the thing about presence.
Unlike Heidegger?
Yeah.
What do you mean?
Just I guess it was more his saying, bringing things into the present just doesn't. So I'm agreeing that I feel like for Heidegger, the past is past and future is future.
I think it's insightful, because when Derrida talks about the living present here, he's actually kind of riffing on this important distinction between Husserl and Heidegger, and Husserl's idea of the transcendental ego and what Heidegger did to dismantle the transcendental ego. So I think Derrida is kind of talking about the state of mind, or the state of metaphysics, or the state of phenomenology, or the state of the transcendental sense of the mind that Heidegger brought us out of, and that it's that transcendental Husserlian earlier version that kind of I guess, renders us always turning things into a living present. Mm-hmm. So I totally agree with you. I think what Heidegger was trying to move out of were ways of thinking in which everything is always a living present.
Mm-hmm.
And that we can understand and experience time as time.
Mm-hmm.
And not always make it present. And, you know, I kind of feel like a little bit, I'm going to say, I think in the current intellectual American regime and the way that American intellectuals, academics think about time and history and the way they maneuver and finagle and machinate concepts across time and look at repetitions in time, rhymes in time.
Mm-hmm.
They render everything very present.
Mm-hmm.
And they negate contextual and time specific differences in order to make everything present. So there's a lot of like if something happens in society in our society, there's a really usually a quick reaction to kind of make a threat that history is repeating itself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that something that happened long ago is present again.
Mm.
Whereas, you know, the question of whether something can be present that was, and how it's present, and whether or not we can actually claim any of it has made it across from past into presence is, you know, that's at the core of phenomenology, and the core of what Heidegger would call questioning.
Mm-hmm.
One thing to question, one of the most important questions I think we can ask is where from comes our right to actually claim that anything can be presenced, that there is a present, and that our interpretation of how things move from the past into the present is in any way correct.
Mm-hmm.
That's a really important question to ask.
Totally.
Okay, that's all.
Heavy
beginning.
Cool. I like that.
It's
cool to hear other people talking about it.
Yeah, I hope to bring in some more stuff. I mean,
yeah.
I've got some cool stuff from the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy that I'd like to read about Heidegger
cool.
And Derrida and who's the guy your dad likes a lot?
Levinas,
exactly. I just finally learned how to use the highlights feature in Kindle book.
Oh wow!
And actually find all the things you can actually just look and see all the things you've highlighted.
Yes, you can. I think you can even export it too.
Incredible. So it's like such a good time to be alive. It's a revolution in my understanding. So with these new tools, I hope to build new buildings. So we're on section 5 of Contributions to Philosophy. And very excited to be reading the book and talking about what it excites in us. So go ahead.
5. For the few, for the rare. For the few who from time to time question again, i.e. newly put the essence of truth up for decision. For the rare who are endowed with the great courage required for solitude, in order to think the nobility of being and to speak of its uniqueness. Thinking in the other beginning is in a unique way originarily historical, the compliant disposing of the essential occurrence of being. A projection of the essential occurrence of being as the event must be ventured because we do not know that to which our history is assigned. Would that we might radically experience the essential occurrence of this unknown assignment in its self-concealing. Should I keep going?
Maybe a little more.
Okay. Let us indeed want to develop this knowledge such that what is unknown and given to us as a task might leave our will in solitude and thereby compel the steadfastness of Dasein to the highest restraint in the face of what is self-concealing. Nearness to the last God is reticence, which must be set into work and word in the style of restraint. To be in nearness of the God, even if this nearness is the most remote remoteness of the undecidability regarding the absconding or advent of the gods, cannot be calculated in terms of, quote, good fortune, end quote, or, quote, misfortune. The constancy of being itself bears in itself its own measure, if a measure is needed at all.
Yeah, I think that's probably good. Maybe?
Yeah.
Yeah, he starts with, for the few, for the rare. Yeah. So they're kind of like toasts. He's toasting to the greats, the few and the rare, who will question again and put the essence of truth up for decision, who are endowed with the courage required for solitude in order to think the nobility of Bang and to speak of its uniqueness, these rare, these few. Then he says, thinking in the other beginning is in a unique way originarily historical, the compliant disposing of the essential occurrence of Bang. Something there about a little what I was talking about in the opening. Thinking in the other beginning, or in one could even say thinking in the Heideggerian way, is originarily historical. So it's not historiological, but it's historical. So the past stays the past, or at least the past is not immediately presenced without questioning how that can even occur. The future, or what we imagine, the what ifs and the fantasies and the visions and the projections and the fears don't become present without asking how that can even happen and what that actually means and if that's even possible other than through the rigors of delusion. And in a sense, the cartoonery of historiology, you know, thinking needs to be originarily historical. It needs to actually live in time or live in Bang, which is the events of time. A projection of the essential occurrence of Bang as the event must be ventured. So Bang is the event. There was an event many years ago. How do we presence it? How does it become presenced? We need to question how that's possible and if it's possible. Because we do not know that to which our history is assigned. Like, our history might not even be assigned to us, right? Our history might not even have anything to do with us. Who says your history made you, right? Who says your history is where you came from? Do we even know that? Would that we might radically experience the essential occurrence of this unknown assignment in its self-concealing. Let's radically experience it. In other words, not presence it immediately. In this unknown assignment, the past, we don't even know if it's assigned to us. And it's a self-concealing thing because, you know, we need to try to understand its truth, which means it's concealed and we need to try to reveal it. So it's this real hide and seek game. The past is not just there for us to make present or to assume that it's assigned to us or to assume that we know how to make it present. It's and same with the future. This whole presencing activity needs to be questioned. Let us indeed want to develop this knowledge such that what is unknown and given to us as a task might leave our will in solitude. A little bit of what I was talking about, the A in scalp, the A in the way identity enslaves the self, anonymity, which is the flip side of community, and the idea of the individual plight versus the group plight. Our will needs to be left in solitude. that it can compel the steadfastness of Dasein, that it can compel the tireless working of being appropriated to Bang into the highest restraint in the face of what is self-concealing, the highest restraint. So restraint and reticence, the last God, big important ideas.
Sorry, can you?
Yeah, I'm going
you
on
explain?
And on.
No.
I want to talk about restraint and reticence, but it's a lot to throw out there. But go ahead.
It is. No, my question was, you brought in anonymity, and I didn't quite understand how you were relating it there.
So, like I talked about last time, self. There's self, and the distinction between self and identity, which I'm making, occurs via these five facets. These five tools by which identity appropriates and negates and controls and, in a sense, seeks to extinguish the self. And the third, the mnemonic for these five tools is S-C-A-L-P. And the third is anonymity, or the identity anonymizes the self. And it does that by communalizing the self. So what I said is anonymity is the flip side of community.
Yeah.
We hear a lot about community and the values of community and the importance of community, which is very identitarian. But what we don't realize is that what in community sounds very comforting, doesn't it? It's like, wow, that would be great to have a community. But inherent to community is anonymity. Anonymity in the sense of losing your individual name. Losing your solitude, becoming unnamed, the individual, because when you become, when you become part of a community, you become inevitably community number 573,000, so in his saying, we must leave the will in solitude to compel the steadfastness of Dasein to the highest restraint. I think what he's, I'm extrapolating that into what I was saying about identity versus self. Self is the will in solitude. Identity is the will anonymized, communized. And then in that, the highest restraint becomes impossible, because once you're member of a community, the community is moving you, the community is informing you, the community is speaking for you, you're speaking for the community, this community is speaking through you, the community is compelling you, motivating you, your energies become the community's, you lose your highest restraint. There's no more restraint. When you're a member of a community, you can't be restrained, or you can't practice restraint. Let's say that. You are restrained, but you can't practice restraint on your own, of your own.
Yeah.
Which I think, again, I think for me, goes back to anxiety, goes back to practice the highest restraint, is to practice the fortitude and the individuality and the solitude and the wherewithal of will and mind to restrain oneself from presencing the past and the future in a way that renders things that are not now, now, and therefore makes the now one of anxiety, of anxiousness. There's something about, I don't know, it's just that, you use that phrase, what if, right? What if this, what if that? Well, those are all asking about the future and making the future present,
Yeah.
And totally. And your inability to shut off the what if is an inability to practice the highest restraint. Why are you unable to practice that restraint? That's an important question. Like, clearly you are, and clearly it would be nice to figure out why and to enable you with the power to practice that restraint. And it would seem there's a little clue in here that apparently your will is not in solitude. Your history has been assigned to you, even though no one ever said that it is actually the history that should be assigned to you.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's nice.
He says, nearness to the last God is reticence, which must be set into work and word in the style of restraint. To be in the nearness of the God, the last God, even if this nearness is the most remote remoteness of the undecidability regarding the absconding or advent of the gods, cannot be calculated in terms of good fortune or misfortune, the constancy of bang itself. So this is a very important two passages. I'm going to explain these passages or attempt to understand these passages, and then we can move on. Is that okay?
Mm-hmm, yeah, totally.
I think we talked about the last God already. I mean, I'm pretty sure we did.
I'm not sure.
Well, I mean, you know, we know that history is a series of gods, series of absolute truths, a series of supernatural, out of nature entities to which apparently all time, mind, and instincts are ascending. And those gods are the rulers, the gods are the judges, the gods are the forces of religion and justice, and they recur, and this God replaces this, and there are so many gods, they're all over the place, right? Mm-hmm. And Heidegger is positing this idea of the last God. If we move out of the first beginning, out of the original metaphysic into the new metaphysic, then this parade of gods will stop, and the last God will appear, the God that emerges out of Dasein's appropriation by Bang and our dedication to the essential currents of Bang. But being near to this last God is reticence. So it's not loud. It's not uncontrolled. And as we get nearer to it, we get more silent. I'm not sure. Reticent. I mean, I'd like to maybe see what German word there is. I mean, it probably means reticence. I mean, there's a humility in the idea of reticence, isn't there? Mm-hmm. There's silence. To remain reticent is to remain reserved. To be in the nearness of the God. So to be, and that's italicized there, right?
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, to have being, to engage in being, and that's important. That's mm-hmm. not bang. That's mm-hmm. to engage in being or to have being in the nearness of the God. And then he has this little parenthetical remark. Even if this nearness is the most remote remoteness of the undecidability regarding the absconding or advent of the gods, even if being near to this God is just the most remote you can be in not being able to decide about how the gods were taken away or how the gods were brought, meaning what the process of God creation and God presence is throughout time. Even if that nearness of this last God is basically a complete ignorance of what makes gods, to be in the nearness of this God cannot be calculated in terms of good fortune or misfortune. Well, there he really just really breaks right away with all relations to God as we've come to understand them, right? Like, are you in God's good graces?
Mm-hmm.
Are you behaving properly vis-a-vis God?
Mm-hmm.
Oh shit! You weren't good to God. Now you're suffering plagues and misfortunes, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he says, this is not at all what I'm talking about. He says the constancy of Bang itself bears in itself its own measure, if you even need a measure at all. The constancy of Bang is the measure by which you determine your nearness to the last God. Very like a religio-revolutionary perspective on a human relationship to a so-called divine. And, you know, last comment, I mean, I think as we sit in 2023 and we hear the word God, especially in a book of philosophy that has a podcast about it, you know, a lot of people's noses are going to turn up. But I think it's really cool that Heidegger is looking into the word God, because I think inevitably what he's going to talk about is the projection that is God, that is God to us and has been throughout history. So it's not about a God as we've understood it. It's about a God as the thing that emerges out of a quest for bang versus a quest for being. And the difference between the God that comes from the quest for bang and the God that comes from the quest for being. We're very familiar with the gods that come from the quest for being, but not so familiar with the God that comes from the quest for bang. And he's saying that, he's putting forth the assertion that that will be the last God. There won't even really be able to be one after that. Anyhow, I'll be quiet.
Go ahead. No, don't say that, please. That's cool. Yeah, the use of the word God has taken me a while to be like, okay. For some reason, it's a very, like, it's a very religious word. So it's like unexpected in this context. But
definitely.
It's a very, like you said, it's a very strong choice, but it's a cool, it works.
Yeah, that's nice, yeah. And it would be really, I think it would be lovely if over the next 25 years of us reading this book, we can slowly, I think, I think it'll be a long road, but I think to come to understand what is meant by that word God to Heidegger and in a Heideggerian context,
yeah,
it might be a really interesting thing. Maybe it's a metaphor for other things we already know, or experience, or have relationships with, or maybe it's a totally new thing.
Yeah.
Maybe it's just metaphor. I don't know, but I guess we'll see. Should we read some more?
Yeah.
This is a long.
Well, it's not capitalized.
It's a long section.
Which is,
what's that?
It's just, it's God is not capitalized, which I don't know.
Yeah, that's right.
Is a thing to not capitalize.
That's really important. Yeah, and you know. He talks about the gods, right?
Yeah.
The absconding or advent of the gods, the coming or going of the gods, like a real Greek.
Yeah, totally.
Like a real polytheist, a
real pagan. But I like how you just framed it in terms of it just being the many gods over time, which is...
Yeah, I mean, which, you know, history is a pagan, isn't it? Or historiology is a pagan, at least, yeah. Historiology has so many gods, yeah. That's right. Humanity has so many gods. Humanity as a whole is a giant polytheist nightmare. But go ahead.
Yeah. Okay. Well said. To which of us today, however, is this constancy granted? We scarcely manage to be prepared for its necessity or even to point to this preparedness as the inception of another course of history.
Yeah, this constancy is the constancy of bang. Yeah, good.
Right. Reversions to the all too familiar modes of thought and claims of metaphysics will still be disturbing for a long time, and will obscure the clarity of the way and the determinateness of the speaking. Nevertheless, the historical moment of the transition must be carried out in the knowledge that all metaphysics, founded on the leading question, what are beings, remained incapable of transposing the human being into the basic relations to beings. And how should it be capable of that? Even the will to do so finds no hearing as long as the truth of bang and the uniqueness of bang have not become needful. Yet how is thinking supposed to succeed in what was previously denied the poet Hölderlin? Or must we merely rid his path and his work of the debris covering them and direct them toward the truth of bang? Are we equipped to do that?
Yeah, we've talked. Hölderlin was a poet that Heidegger liked a lot. And I would not be surprised, I'm having some kind of weird memory of this, if the last God is actually a phrase stolen from Hölderlin or lifted from Hölderlin, if that word, that idea is central to Hölderlin's poetry. Maybe I'll have to check it out. All pretty clear. I mean, I think he says, all metaphysics, which are founded on the leading question, what are beings? So metaphysics up to now, when he's writing this book, have been, what are beings? What are things that have being? That whole system was incapable of transposing the human being into the basic relations to beings. So in holding us in what are beings, we were removed from the possibility of being transposed into having a basic relation to beings, a basic relation, whatever that means. And in fact, how could it ever do it until the truth of Bang and the uniqueness of Bang had become needful, like we need it. We're not just curious about it. We need it. And you know, why would we come to need Bang? What could lead us to need Bang? We just have been buzzing along in this historiological train ride for thousands of years, asking what are beings, assuming so many things about being that we never needed Bang. But all of a sudden he's saying Bang is actually needed or needs to become needful for us to start to have basic relations to beings. So I think it's an interesting question about what could be going on with us such that we need Bang. Mm-hmm. And I think there's something about anxiety there.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's something about identity and anxiety coming together and leading us to see that our metaphysical trajectory, as we've been trotting it for thousands of years, is just getting us deeper into the hole. And that we need something to help us get out of that hole.
Yeah.
That our thinking heretofore has not brought us freedom.
Yeah.
And how can we be free? We need to be free. I think our need for freedom predetermines our thinking. And so Bang is, I think, being put forth as Heidegger as that which we need to make our thinking an agent of our freedom.
Hmm. Yeah, that's nice.
And so, and he continues to talk about this needfulness. Why don't we go on?
The truth of Bang becomes needful only through the questioners. They are the genuine believers because they, by opening up the essence of truth, adhere to the ground.
That's right. The believers, the questioners, adhere to the ground, which is Bang, the truth of Bang. They don't just ask what are beings, and they don't just have a non-basic relationship to beings. They adhere to the ground of beings, being the truth of Bang and the events of Bang. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. The questioners, alone and without resorting to any magic charm, place the new and highest degree of steadfastness in the middle of Bang. In the essential occurrence of Bang, the event as the middle.
Yep, steadfastness is placed into the middle of Bang by the questioners in order to experience Bang, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Keep going.
The questioners have broken the habit of curiosity. Their seeking loves the abyss in which they know the oldest ground.
Yeah, curiosity is a pejorative here.
Yeah.
Being curious about things. Questioners are much more abyssal and seeking of the oldest ground than one can assign to the practice or the habit of curiosity. Yeah, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. If a history should be granted us once again, namely the creative exposure to beings out of a belonging to being, then the destiny is inescapable. To prepare the time space of the last decision, whether and how we experience and ground this belonging, that means to ground through thought the knowledge of the event by way of the grounding as Dasein of the essence of truth.
Very thick, yeah.
Yeah.
If a history should be granted us once again, in other words, if we should be granted an experience of time that is not a chronic and addictive presencing.
Mm-hmm.
Which would be, as he says, a creative exposure to beings out of a belonging to being. So we would belong to being again in a genuine way and thereby be creatively exposed to beings, not determinatively and identitarianly exposed to beings, then the destiny is inescapable. This is then here's the destiny of this: to prepare the time space of the last decision. And I think the last decision is to ground Dasein in the essence of truth.
Hmm.
Here's the last decision: whether or not and how we experience and ground this belonging to being. How do we experience it? Do we experience it? Do we ground it? Or do we not ground it? Does it just remain ungrounded? And it is grounded in bang, so do we do that? This means to ground through thought the knowledge of the event, or bang, by way of the grounding of the essence of truth. So it's lovely.
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
No matter how the decision may turn out regarding history and lack of history, the questioners who in thought prepare that decision must be. May they all bear the solitude in their greatest hour.
I feel like we need strings.
Yeah.
Right? There's epicness in this.
Yeah.
I mean, these toasts are just like, you know. Yeah, okay, go ahead.
Yeah.
That's right. He's so aware that people are reading the book, or he seems to be aware that people are reading this book and feeling this sense of mission and decision and journey in their solitude that he has inspired them to.
Hmm.
Yeah, go ahead.
Which saying affects the highest thoughtful reticence? Which procedure is most likely to bring about reflection on being? The saying of truth, for truth is the quote between for the essential occurrence of being and for the beingness of beings. This quote between grounds the beingness of beings in bang.
Yeah, so he answers, he asks, which saying will affect the highest thoughtful reticence and which procedure will bring about the reflection on bang? And the answer is the saying of truth. For truth mm-hmm. is the between for the essential occurrence of bang and for the beingness of beings. It's between, truth lies between the essential occurrence of bang and the beingness of beings. And this between grounds the beingness of beings in bang via the in-between, which mm-hmm. is truth, or mm-hmm. the saying of truth.
Hmm.
Truth, not a word that is super popular today. I mean, in the sense of anybody knowing what it means or agreeing on it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yet bang is not something, quote, earlier, existing in itself for itself. Instead, the event is the temporal spatial simultaneity for bang and beings.
Yeah, so bang and beings occur together in the event. Bang is not before beings and does not exist in and of itself. It exists with beings in the temporal spatial simultaneity.
So how does that work with the, if we like go with the idea of identity and self, they're saying that they do exist together? I mean, maybe
you mean he says the event is the temporal spatial simultaneity of bang and beings?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so that's a good question. I think when he says bang and beings, beings are different than being.
Yeah.
And beings are different than the beingness of being. The beingness of beings, sorry. Right. So when I say identity and self, I mean the beingness of beings, or being kind of with a capital B.
Hmm.
Beings are the, I would say almost, well, in a sense, what he's saying here is that bang and beings occur together in certain time-space moments.
Mm-hmm.
And they, in a sense, they kind of need each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a, you know, if we were to say bang is self and being with a capital B is identity, then what are beings?
Mm-hmm.
But of course, you know, self is not without recognition.
Mm-hmm.
And recognition is different than identity.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say the trajectory of liberation to free oneself from identity and be in the self is not a liberation that then renders one simply, how should we say, momentous in a way that there is no recognition of the recurrence of the self over time and space.
Mm-hmm.
Self is a being.
Mm-hmm.
And self is in a world with beings. But the nature of self is to be bang, or self is to actually be bang and beings together.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to be my answer.
Yeah, that's a good answer.
Yeah, but I think there's much more to be answered there.
Definitely.
And I think it's a really profound, interesting question. I think that the idea of beings in this book and the word, so there's three iterations of this word, not iterations, but three kind of tributaries or corners of the being triangle in this book. And that is the word being as a abstract noun,
mm-hmm.
beingness as the essence of being, as an abstraction of the abstract noun, and beings, and how they all relate
mm-hmm.
is a very good question.
Yeah. And bang, in a way, is also, right? It's a,
yes. And then there's
another
bang.
Version of...
Yep.
Or it's another spelling of being.
Yeah, that's right.
Yes.
Great. Should we keep reading? I mean... Or is there something?
Oh, no, are we?
I mean, we have a little ways to go to finish five.
I know we do.
We could just struggle to finish five, I guess, right? I feel like we're just like explaining.
Five is pretty fat.
Huh?
Oh, five is really long.
Well, we have one, two.
That's really long.
we have three paragraphs and a tiny paragraph.
No, it keeps going after that, but we could go to there.
Oh, it does. Oh, geez. No, we can't finish. No, five is way too long.
Yeah.
I mean, is there anything you want to mention that we've already talked about? I mean, that makes you think of anything, or do you want to just keep reading?
Nothing comes to mind for me.
Okay, well, let's keep reading.
Okay. In philosophy, propositions are never subject to proof. Can you explain that? What are propositions in philosophy?
Well, I think I can. I think you should read the paragraph because I think there's some stuff in there that helps clarify that.
This is so not only because there are no highest propositions from which others could be derived, but because here, quote, propositions are not at all what is true, nor are propositions simply that about which they speak. All, quote, proving presupposes that those who understand as they come to stand before the represented content of the proposition remain the same, unaltered, in following the representational nexus that bears the proof. And only the, quote, result of the course of the proof can require a changed mode of representation, or rather require the representing of something previously unheeded.
Yeah, so I don't need to explain it, right?
That's all. Yeah, that totally makes sense.
Let me read this. A proposition is a central concept in the philosophy of language, semantics, and logic, and is often characterized as the primary bearer of truth or falsity. Propositions are also often characterized as being the kind of thing that declarative sentences denote. For instance, the sentence, "the sky is blue," denotes the proposition that the sky is blue. So propositions are truth claims, I would say. And as this little entry that I just read makes clear, propositions are central concepts in the philosophy of language, semantics, and logic. And in a sense, there are propositions in mathematics as well, which is another form of logic. But when he says in philosophy, I think he's talking not about the philosophy of language, semantics, or logic. I think he's talking about something else. But he says, propositions are never subject to proof. So in other words, he's saying that we're not going to – in philosophy, when there's claims of truth, there's not going to be any proof for those things to be true. You know, there are mathematical proofs. There are logical proofs. But he's saying there in philosophy, these are not going to exist. And this is not only because there are no highest propositions, and highest propositions is a term they use for propositions that are kind of accepted as true. So they're used as, you know, like one equals one. That's a highest proposition. It's accepted as true. People don't argue it. It's used, for instance, the first law of logic is the law of identity. Everything is equal to itself. And that is not debatable. That's the highest proposition. He says in philosophy, there are none of those. It's also, propositions are also not subject to proof because propositions are not at all what is true in philosophy. So he's making a different definition of propositions in philosophy. Nor are propositions simply about that about which they speak. All proving presupposes that those who understand, as they come to stand before the represented content of the proposition, remain the same. So, unaltered in following the representational nexus that bears the proof. And only the result of the course of the proof can require a changed mode of representation. And only the result can require a changed mode of representation, or rather require the representing of something previous. So, basically what he's saying is, in things like logic and mathematics, proving presupposes that those who understand this proof as they come to stand before the content of the proposition remain the same. They don't change. They just follow the proof. They remain unaltered in following the representational nexus that bears the proof. So in logic, one assumes that the person who's observing, going through, considering, relating to the proof of the proposition remains the same. And the only result of this course of the proof, only the result of where the proof ends up as true or false, results in a change. So I change, oh gosh, it's been proven false. Now I change. Oh, it's been proven true. Oh, now I know it's true. He says, this is the assumption of how we relate to proofs. And he says, that is not what actually happens in philosophy. So he's drawing a real distinction here between logic, mathematics, the philosophy of language and semantics, and what he calls philosophy. Now, let's hear how we interact with proof in philosophy, because that's what he talks about in the next paragraph.
In philosophical knowledge, on the contrary, the very first step sets in motion a transformation of the one who understands. And this is not in the moral existential sense, but rather with respect to Dasein. In other words, the relation to being and, ever prior to that, the relation to the truth of being are transformed in the mode of the transportation into Dasein itself.
The transposition into Dasein itself, that's right.
Because in philosophical knowledge, in each case, everything is transformed at once. The being of humans into its standing in the truth itself, and thereby the relation to being. And because, accordingly, an immediate representation of something objectively present is never possible, philosophical thinking will always seem strange.
Yeah. Super cool, right? Philosophical thinking, philosophical knowledge, in its very first step, sets into motion a transformation of the one who engages in the thinking and the knowledge, or the understanding of the knowledge. So transformation is occurring all the time. In the prior paragraph, he used words like unaltered, remains the same. Change only occurred as a result of the proof. In philosophical knowledge, the change starts happening immediately, specifically in the way Dasein, begins to relate to Bang. And understanding renders the subject, the thinker, different at every turn, and that transformation is always occurring. There's no, how should we say, he says at the very end, an immediate representation of something objectively present, the way one might find in the representational nexus of a truth, of a proof, for instance, is never possible. And this feels very much to me a little like a dichotomy of identity and self. Identity remains unaltered in the presence of the proof, and only the result of the course of the proof brings about a change in the mode of identity. And identity feigns at a objective representation of highest propositions. Which is why identity is unphilosophical, and why identity is actually not thought. Identity is a series of proofs that preserve the observer from change, that prevent change in the observer, shield the observer from change in a certain sense. But philosophy is the self establishing and being transformed immediately into relations to bang, Dasein, relating to bang and being transformed in thought, through thought, without any immediate representation of something objectively present. It's just constant transformation. And it seems strange. Because it is strange. Strange is an important word. It's strange because at every turn, you become a stranger. You're operating outside identity. So immediately you seem strange to yourself, to the self you were a second ago, to others, etc.
That's nice. Should we keep going, or is that, I like that point.
I think that's pretty good.
As an ending point, actually.
I agree. I think that's pretty good. I mean, I think it's exciting for him to put forth a definition of philosophy that distinguishes it from a lot of things that we normally attribute to philosophy.
Yeah.
So he's really laying out some borderlands here, some borderlines, saying this is philosophy over here. Over here, this is not philosophy. He's linking philosophy with self, with Dasein, with Bang, with transformation, with strangeness, with no objective present, objectively present presence, with
yeah, it really ties back to the original.
Yeah, with he's linking philosophy to a way of being or a way of Bang that does not exist or transform everything into an immediate representation of an objectively present. And so, you know, going back in a way to the beginning, you know, I don't know why I'm so transfixed on anxiety right now, other than I think it's been a topic of ours over the last couple of days, right? Where your mind is in time, where you are in time, where yourself is in time, where yourselves are in time, and how you put them all into the same bowl of soup or the same prison or the same sentence or the same proposition or the same proof, how you do that is what the questioning needs to be about. And in every example and every moment of your being, as you experience it, you have to do the rigorous work to say, how am I presencing things that are not present? Yeah. How has my history been assigned to me by people with no interest in verifying whether that assignment belongs to me? And without any questioning of the validity of that assignment. And how can I live in the freedom that is myself being transformed at every step by the questioning that is the philosophy of establishing a relation to Bang that sets me free from an objectively present that is nothing but a falsehood that perpetuates my anxiety because I'm stuck in between what I cannot know and what I think I know, neither of which I know.
Yeah. Yeah, that's nice. That's really nice.
You know, I mean, I think... So this, we're really talking here about like a philosophical path to liberation from the deep state of thought that leads one to be orchestrated by others, not who have a malicious intent, but who are not practicing philosophy. Who are practicing something else. And you get wrapped up, you get sucked up, you get brought into their immediate representation of an objective present. And you don't know where you're coming from, and you don't know where you're going, and you don't know where you are. I was thinking like the thing about this living present, as Derrida talked about, this, you know, live in the now.
Yeah.
I feel like live in the now, be here now, which, you know, in a sense could be, you know, I mean, that's an ancient mantra brought from the East, you know, but it's all the rage, has been all the rage in where we live for 60 years. I was always a little suspicious of it. And I think it's because in reading that little Derrida quote and then looking through this, it's like, I think when I hear so many people are here say, be here now, live in the now, it seems to entail, well, I think they think it involves a segregation or a separation from the past and the future. I think it actually often entails a presencing of the past and a presencing of the future, which is why I would say, you know, anxiety is so endemic to the spiritualists of today. That's what I would say.
Yeah, interesting.
The spiritualists, and what spirituality has become. Spirituality has become a pharmaceutical company whose sole product is a vaccine against anxiety that you need to get shot up with 4 times a day. Does that sound...
Yeah, totally.
Extreme?
No, I don't think that's extreme. Okay.
And in that accurate. Living present, the thing that's so comforting to so many people about the living present is the subject. You can't tell the difference between the subject and the predicate.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this delusion of becoming what you are.
One.
Whole. Exactly. But in fact, you are just frozen in an unchanging proof relationship that perpetuates an immediate representation of an objective present that snares you in an identity that is pure anxiety.
Yeah.
So I've used...
Exactly.
I feel like I've used like 6 words tonight. I've just kind of like changed them around. It's like, as I say about Mexican food, right? It's like, it's the same 6 ingredients, just in different forms. All very delicious. Big, big Mexican food fan. That's it.
Yeah.
That's it. It's cold tonight.
Yeah.
And it's late. I guess we're going to bed, right? Nothing to say?
No, I've enjoyed it very much, but I am nauseous.
Yes, good.
I am very nauseous.
You have had a nauseous day. The pregnancy proceeds apace, for those who are wondering.
Yes.
How pregnant are you?
I think we're at like 9 weeks.
9 weeks. That's over 2 months old.
Baby is.
Do you have any idea how big a 2-month old baby is?
I have not opened that app yet.
Yeah. I'm going to guess it's like one of those donut holes. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not like a lima bean, and it's not like a, it's not that small. I think it's kind of like, it's not like a golf ball. It's like maybe 2 centimeters. That's going to be my guess.
Okay.
But, yeah.
It's a powerful 2 centimeters, man.
Yeah. Well, your nausea will end soon.
Yes.
All right. Love to everyone.
Yes. Thank you.
Good night.
Thanks for joining us for the Leaping Choya podcast. For more information, visit leapingchoya.com and be sure and follow us on socials. Until next time.